This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. If you're hiring, with Indeed, you can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on your short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Get started at Indeed.com/NPR podcast.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Fall 2015, the campus of Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut.
It is not about creating an intellectual space. It is not. Do you understand that? It's about creating a home here. You are not doing that.
There was a lot of protest and shouting and some hostility from students toward Yale professors who challenged students to stand up for their right to wear whatever Halloween costume they want, even if that costume might be offensive. Now, that's just one of many incidents in the past couple of years, but there are even deeper trends. Colleges and universities are supposed to be the place where the universe of ideas are vigorously debated, but now they seem to be home to trigger warnings and safe spaces and possibly even a culture of fragility among students. Well, our guests say that even with the best of intentions, some very bad ideas are setting an entire generation up for failure. So this hour on Point, the coddling of the American mind and what to do about it. You can join us. Are you seeing a, quote, cult of safety on your campus? And what effect do you think that's having on young people? Or is safety really in something else? Is it respect for individuals and their experience? More broadly, what's happening across America, where words and ideas now have become weapons to fear? And how do we fix that? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Well, joining me now from Washington is Greg Lukianoff. He's president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE. They're a group that advocates for free speech on American campuses. Greg Lukianoff, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us from New York is Jonathan Haidt. He's social psychologist and professor of ethical leadership at New York University's Stern School of Business. Jonathan Haidt, welcome to Radio Boston. Welcome to On Point. I'm still making a transition to being in this new chair, Jonathan. But Jonathan and Greg are co-authors of this terrific new book. It's called The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. And we've got an excerpt of that at onpointradio.org. Now, Greg and John, I just wanted to start off with a couple more specific examples about the kinds of things that you say we're seeing on college campuses. And your book is full of them. So can we just start with one? You talked about how at Brown University a while back, there was a speaker who came onto campus to dispute that America has a so-called, quote-unquote, rape culture. And this is a woman who had been sexually assaulted herself. Now, the presence of the speaker on campus caused so much controversy that Brown University felt they had to create literally a safe space room about that. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Greg, I think you're more familiar with the case. Why don't you take it?
Oh, absolutely. Sure. This was a case in which Jessica Valenti was supposed to debate Wendy McElroy about whether or not there was such a thing as a rape culture, an American culture. In response to it, not only did President Paxson create alternative programming, but students got together and created a safe space on campus. And this was covered by Judith Shulevitz in the New York Times. And even though I've been working defending free speech on college campuses since 2001, I hadn't heard of anything like this. I found out basically the same time the rest of the country did. And what was so strange about it was that it featured, you know, Play-Doh and frolicking puppies and all of this kind of thing that seemed to be sort of this self-infantilization approach, as if the very debate itself would be medically harmful to students. And these were the kind of trends that really made an impression on me back in 2013, 2014. And why I approached John about some of my thoughts on this was because whereas I was used to people making arguments for censorship on campus based on offensiveness, based on bigotry, based on all of these kind of standard arguments, but the new arguments around 2013, 2014 were medicalized. They seemed to be saying that having Jessica, Wendy McElroy on campus by itself would be traumatic. And so I wanted to talk to John about how I thought this could become sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, and also that it went against everything I knew about psychology. And also, of course, it does pose a problem for free speech if you're actually treating dissenting speakers as if they're actually toxic to the environment of a campus.
Right. And so, Jonathan Haidt, I mean, there are so many examples that we can point to. In the Atlantic article that you and Greg wrote several years ago that really touched off so much discussion about this, you point to yet another. And this is during the 2014-2015 school year, deans and department chairs at the University of California system at 10 schools there were presented with they had microaggression faculty training, right? And they were presented with actual lists of so-called offensive statements. I put those in quotes. Right. And the statements included, "America is the land of opportunity, and I believe the most qualified person could get the job." So the assertion was that saying these things could cause harm to students?
Mm-hmm. That's right. So we've made enormous progress in American society in terms of explicit and overt racism. And the norms have changed, and especially on university campuses. We're very, very sensitive about such things. And there was an interesting article published in 2007 by a psychologist at Teachers College who popularized the term microaggressions. And had he defined it in terms of small aggressions, like somebody could say something under their breath or maybe it's a cutting comment that they can deny, it would have been a useful concept. There can be small aggressions. Unfortunately, the way the term is defined, it even says that these acts, these statements or actions may be unintentional. They may even be well-intentioned. So if someone offers to help, or if someone praises someone's English, or if someone says, "Where are you from?" And what they really mean is, "Which country are you from? Because, you know, I've been to Korea and I'm really interested in it." A person could take that as a statement that you're different, you're an outsider, you don't belong here.
Let me just say, like, as a person who gets that question all the time, where are you born, where are you from, I personally don't consider it a microaggression. I consider it macro ignorance about what it means to be American.
But that's perfect right there. The line between aggression and a faux pas is a gigantic, enormous, important line. And if we are trying to create diverse environments on campus, and we really, really are, we're doing so much to create international diversity, racial diversity, sexual orientation diversity, and openness. So we're trying to create a very special kind of community. And if we were to say, now, we all have to try to be less offensive and also take less offense, there's no way this can work unless we give each other the benefit of the doubt, because, boy, are there going to be misunderstandings.
You know,
and
so,
instead...
Forgive me for interrupting. Go ahead and complete your thought.
Oh, just instead, we've introduced this notion of microaggressions, which is to say, whatever someone says, take it in the worst possible way. Think, is there some way that this statement could make you feel bad, could make you feel marginalized, could be taken as putting you on the margins? And if so, then it is a microaggression. And if someone has committed an act of aggression around you, in fact, if every day dozens of people are committing an act of aggression around you, well, of course you're going to feel marginalized. Of course you're not going to dive in. Of course you're going to be upset and fearful.
Well, so there are so many examples of this. And I just want to say that there are – we're talking about experiences that many students do indeed say they are living and feeling and experiencing every day. And it does have an effect on them. I mean, I just want to play a couple of more examples here if I can. So first of all, this is 2015, and students at Claremont McKenna College in California, where they protested the dean of students, Mary Spellman, after she referred to some students there who, quote, "don't fit the mold of college." And this was in response to a Hispanic student's editorial about their feelings of marginalization and exclusion. And here's one student responding to Spellman during an hour-long session.
"Now you put into writing that we don't fit the mold. Nothing that you have said has made me feel like I am protected by you, that I am safe in your office. Nothing. And that's not going to change by saying sorry or by crying crocodile tears in front of everybody."
So that language there, nothing made her feel like I am, quote, protected by you. Now, in 2017, we had a discussion here at WBUR about a violent protest that happened at Middlebury College. And I, at that time, spoke with a Middlebury College senior, Elizabeth Soo-Yun Lee. Now, this protest at Middlebury happened in response to the invitation of Charles Murray to campus. So he's obviously a very controversial writer and speaker who has published books that have been wildly debunked by now about links between race and IQ. So there was a lot of protest at Middlebury there then over Murray coming to campus. And here's why Elizabeth Soo-Yun Lee told me his theories on race and IQ are so problematic.
He's literally saying Asians have higher IQs than whites, which means that Asians have to suffer a lot of the mental health issues that come with having an expectation of being higher IQ. And so I think that when it comes to this large power dynamic, it is absolutely necessary, or it is more necessary, for people to be able to stand up for themselves and to say what you're saying is wrong.
So John and Greg, I mean, I don't doubt that these students feel this way. They do feel harmed. But you're saying that there's something wrong with that, that they shouldn't be feeling harmed? I mean, John, explain it to me.
Mm-hmm. So let's go to our second grade untruth, which we call the untruth of emotional reasoning. Always trust your feelings. And so the Stoic philosophers and, in fact, wise people from every culture, this is the biggest idea in my first book, The Happiness Hypothesis. Wise people in every society have told us that the world does not affect us directly. It is only through our appraisals. So here's Marcus Aurelius. You don't have to turn this into something. It doesn't have to upset you. Things can't shape our decisions by themselves. Here's Buddha. Our life is the creation of our mind. Here's Hamlet. There's nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. So let's think about the situation at Middlebury. Charles Murray wrote a very controversial book in 1994. There was a lot of debate around it. He then wrote a couple of other books, including one about social class. He was scheduled to speak on his book on social class on why it is that the white working class has moved away from the Democratic Party. What is its moral worldview? Why did they go to Trump? This is one of the most important questions students could have been interested in and talking about in the wake of the Trump election. But it was deemed to be dangerous to let him talk on that topic on campus.
Mm. Well, we will pick that up, that thought, when we come back, because Greg and John, you quote in your book a professor who wrote in The Washington Post that, quote, no one should have to pass someone else's ideological purity test to be allowed to speak. And yet a lot of people see that that is what's happening on American colleges college campuses. I'm speaking with Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt. They are co-authors of the new book, The Coddling of the American Mind. We'll hear a lot more from them when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from On Point sponsor, Union of Concerned Scientists, creators of Got Science, a biweekly podcast where scientists break down why science matters to all of us. Got Science explores innovations in clean technology and climate solutions, the challenges of missile defense, and how science is critical to strengthening our democracy. Tune in on your favorite podcast app or at gotsciencepodcast.org.
Hey, Tamara.
Hey, Domenico. All week long, Brett Kavanaugh will face his Senate confirmation hearings.
Yeah, he's President Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court, and there are going to be a lot of questions about how he could transform the Supreme Court for a generation.
The NPR Politics podcast will be following those hearings, and we'll hop in the studio every day to break down what you need to know.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking today with Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff. They are co-authors of the new book, The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. And they talk about what they see as a cult of safety on American campuses and how that may actually be doing more harm than good for American young people. And we'd love to know what you think. And I want to just play a little bit of tape here. This is during a conversation at the University of Chicago just last year. CNN host and political commentator and progressive activist Van Jones really pushed back against what he sees as ideological or emotional safe spaces. And he said, you know, where kids need to feel good all the time and not encounter speech or actions they don't like or agree with. And he said he doesn't like that.
I don't want you to be safe ideologically. I don't want you to be safe emotionally. I want you to be strong. That's different. I'm not going to pave the jungle for you. Put on some boots and learn how to deal with adversity. I'm not going to take all the weights out of the gym. That's the whole point of the gym. This is the gym.
That's Van Jones speaking last year at the University of Chicago. John and Greg, I mean, you call it in the book, you call it a cult of safety or vindictive protectiveness. I mean, is it really as bad as that? Tell me more.
Okay. Well, for starters, we should make clear that it's not as though some virus has descended on American universities and eaten the brains of our college kids. Right. There are 4,500 schools in the United States, and on most of them, there's not much of this happening. When we look at the elite schools in the Northeast and on the West Coast, we talk to students there. Some of these dynamics do seem to be happening on most or all of those schools. It's not in the engineering school, not much in the business school. It's more in a few departments. So we don't want to get carried away and make it sound as though, but basically we don't want to play into the moral panic that is occurring on the right. The conservative media loves to attack universities, and they do try to blow it up to make it sound as though all the professors are Marxists indoctrinating their students. And that's not true.
And yet you've written a whole book, though.
because what has changed is the dynamic around speech. And that's what brought me and Greg together. So at elite schools, there used to be a fair degree you could hash things out. You could talk about all sorts of things. But like I just heard a story yesterday from a friend of mine whose daughter attends actually one of the Claremont colleges that we were just talking about. And she was out with her friends and she said, I'm starving. And they called her out on that. They said, that's offensive. There are people who are really starving. Now, if that's the way we are policing each other's language, that leads to an attitude of self-censorship. It means you have to always be self-monitoring. And it's very bad for exploration. It's very bad for trust. So what we're saying is not that people have lost their minds, but that the dynamic has changed. And social media is a very big part of that. And it's making it very hard for us to do our work, to have open discussions, to speak fearlessly, and to trust each other.
So, Greg, talk to me more about this, because I think the social media aspect is really important. Not only is there, as you and John write in the book, a sort of calling out culture, that's your phrase, on American campuses, but it's put into light speed with the possibility of immediate public shaming through social media.
Yeah, absolutely. We look at different causal threads in the book for why we think we've seen, and probably one of the most upsetting, but at the same time, most important things that we discovered while researching the book is this sharp increase in anxiety and depression among younger people that particularly disproportionately affects young women and girls. We also point to, as a causal thread of the problems we see on campus, increased polarization, partially brought about by the fact that we can live in social media environments that are more like echo chambers. And so both of these threads, we believe, are made worse by the power of social media to be a 24-hour presence in our life, the fact that it rewards you essentially for being within an echo chamber, the fact that it actually can turn into an environment that feels like the worst aspects of junior high school 24 hours a day for the rest of your life, which doesn't sound all that pleasant to me. And it's led to, and actually to talk about one thing that distinguishes this book from some of the kind of stereotypes people have of the problem on campus, absolutely the latest trend we've seen is the rise of sort of the more right-wing outrage mobs going after professors on campus. So now I really feel like campus administrators and professors in particular are in a pretty rough position. They have to worry about even saying something with goodwill, but a misstatement they say in class that angers a student that might be perfectly innocent. And they also have to worry about it getting out to the right-wing Twitter sphere, because we've seen a bunch of cases just in the past couple of years, one going on right now at Rutgers, by the way, where a professor, a white professor, complained about gentrification in Harlem. And he wrote, he was a little angry about it, but he said, I want to resign from the white race. And they found him guilty of racial harassment of white people, himself a white person, complaining about something that New Yorkers complain about all the time, partially in response to the right-wing outrage mob that grew out of his comments being made public. So now we have this really nasty situation where it's coming from both directions.
So we see this sort of gelling in perhaps a harmful way on U.S. campuses. But, I mean, you were talking about sort of the potential causes for all this, that coming together at this point in time in American history. But John, let me turn back to you for a second here, because I'm still taken by the analysis that you and Greg have in this book, that the real key difference is that people are asserting that they are genuinely harmed by certain speech, right, or certain mm-hmm. actions or certain opinions, and that they must be protected from that harm. That seems to be, you know, the primary difference between this and, you know, other outrages against speech in the past. I mean, where did this notion that there's harm being done come from?
Yeah. Well, so I think there's two separate things going on here. The first is that we have to recognize that these claims about harm are partly real, that is, they partly do believe it, but they're also partly a rhetorical move. So as the cultural war heats up and intensifies on campus, and as more parts of life are about fighting the left-right culture war, people will use any rhetorical move to gain an edge. And so the claim isn't usually, hey, if that person comes, I will have a nervous breakdown, I will be re-traumatized. It's my fellow students will, this group, that group, they're vulnerable. So in part, it's appearing to stand up for others by saying they are so vulnerable, their PTSD will be reactivated. So I think Greg and I never use the term snowflake because we don't think that students are snowflakes. We don't think that they're truly fragile. We do think that they were way, way overprotected in the early from the early 90s on. And so that brings us to the part of this that is real. Part of it is real is that kids have always had a lot of free time. If you look at how hunter-gatherer kids are raised, they're out in the woods practicing the skills of adulthood. They're practicing hunting and chasing and playing tag and avoiding predators and catching prey. So childhood is play for adulthood. And a lot of countries still understand this. In Scandinavia, they don't really start academic preparation until about age seven. They think that kids need to play early. And there's a lot of psychology that backs them up. Now, in the US and the UK, we got this ridiculous, stupid, totally wrong notion that, you know what? If we start them earlier, they'll get a head start and they'll make it further. So if we start teaching them to read at five, no, four, no, let's try three, that this will somehow make them better, you know, better analytic skills. They'll be better readers when they're adults. And it's totally not true. And what it's doing is it's crowding out play. It's crowding out the thousands and thousands of hours kids need of being out, being in conflicts and resolving them, of falling down and getting up, of being unsupervised and therefore learning how to be independent.
Can I just jump in here, John, for a second? Because, I mean, I'm just wondering, is it – nothing's ever as simple as that. But so my question may oversimplify here. Forgive me if it does. But is, you know, sort of not having the rough and tumble play out on the street as a kid, you're drawing a line between that and – it's what seems to be some students' unwillingness to even broach or listen to ideas or points of view that they might disagree with?
Yes, and here's the link. So first, we review a lot of research in developmental psychology. There's a lot of interesting writing and research on how play builds social skills. Play leads to the ability to resolve conflicts better. There are some pretty good links to mental health, to anxiety and depression. So that's the first thing, is if you get more kids coming in who have anxiety and depression, then there's just a lot more chance for conflict, for saying, you're harming me, you're traumatizing me. But the second link, which I think is even more interesting, is a term that sociologists call moral dependence. And so if you have thousands of hours of resolving conflicts on the playground, playing a pickup game of soccer and working things out without a referee, you come to college, you're able to resolve small conflicts. But kids since the 90s have been raised with the ethos of tell an adult. Don't resolve this yourself. Don't ever hit back. Don't tease. That's bullying. So if they've been taught, tell an adult, tell an adult, tell an adult, and there's always an adult present, and then they come to college, so now they overhear a joke. So they overhear two students telling a joke to each other. What should they do about that? And, you know, the answer could be nothing, just ignore it. The answer could be go talk to them and say that was rude and here's why. Or the answer could be file charges, initiate bureaucratic proceedings and get them punished. Now, if students are raised in the state of moral dependence where when they feel offended, they look for the relevant authority to report them to, this, we believe, is one reason why we saw this explosion of student complaints in 2014, 2015.
Well, and then perhaps what's exacerbating that is that the institutions surrounding them, universities are willing to play that protector role.
Exactly.
They are being very proactive in that protector role.
I mean, you could call it proactive. Greg, what would you call it?
Well, we actually have a whole chapter on how non-ideological forces like bureaucratization, corporatization of universities, and fear of lawsuits. And my people, lawyers, are responsible for so many distortions in modern society. You can see this very much on campus. But I did want to jump back quickly to a point that's really important for me to make.
And
about
Greg, I don't mean to sure. Push you along here, but we have so many callers who want to join us and want to make space for them. But go ahead and complete your thought.
About harm and speech, that essentially that there's nothing older. There's no more ancient idea that speech and opinions are harmful. What is new, at least historically, is the idea that we should listen to people we disagree with, that we should listen to people who aren't kin, that there's actually a value in listening to people who dissent from us. So in a sense, we're getting back to an idea that speech is harmful, that is a bad idea that I think we should have left in the past.
Okay. Well, we are talking with Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt. They are co-authors of the new book, The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. And we've actually got a lot of comments coming in online. Shocking, right? Hans Rosenschwein telling us on Facebook that college used to be where you went to be exposed to new and familiar and oftentimes uncomfortable facts. Generations of students have survived without being traumatized. If someone feels they can't handle this, they aren't ready for college. Whereas Andrew says, if the world is full of bullies and bigots, we should make sure to adjust child rearing around bullies and bigots, he asks. No, I'm going to have to disagree. Give bullies and bigots a taste of their own medicine instead. Let's go to Max, who's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Max.
Hi, Mega. Thanks for having me. Super glad to be on the program, and I think this is a really important conversation to be having. I graduated from Hampshire College in Western Mass, where the culture is explosive around this topic, but the conversation continues to happen. And I think that something that I'm hearing here is this distinction between intent and impact, and the onus seems to be being placed on marginalized communities to be more generous in their forgiveness when people make really ignorant, often racist, and bigoted comments, or take those actions that reflect racist, bigoted, and ignorant perspectives. And when they're called in and told to take account and responsibility for their actions and expressions, thoughts, or otherwise, they react defensively immediately and are not being taught how to take accountability and be vulnerable when being criticized and critiqued for actions that on a larger level, you know, in our society have real impact in their lives and in the lives of people in their community.
So Max, let me just take it back from here because I appreciate your call. I mean, Jonathan Haidt, I think what Max is saying is that the onus shouldn't be on, in his words, marginalized communities to be more generous when being confronted with speech that offends them, but rather the mainstream around them to be more tolerant of the feelings of these very communities.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would never want to deny that if you come to college and you're African American or you're something other than heterosexual sexual identity, that there will be indignities, there will be uncomfortable times, there will occasionally even be acts of aggression against you. I would not want to deny that, nor would I want to say the answer is just suck it up and forget it. Rather, what I'm trying to do here, what Greg and I are trying to do is say, let's try to actually solve the problem. What would it take to actually create a climate in which everyone feels welcome to speak? And so we all agree, and I think I agree with Max and most of our critics, that it's important to train people to be less offensive, especially if you have a very international student body. People have to know how what kinds of jokes are not okay? How do you talk about gender and sex? So you need to reduce the amount of offensiveness. But if at the same time you lower the bar for what counts as offensive to the point where if someone simply says, you know, I personally think that the best person for the job should get the job, if you lower the bar so far that innocent statements that have no malice whatsoever and are not aggressive in any way, that those now count as offensive and harmful, then you're running in place. You do all this work and you've achieved nothing. Your black students, your students of various identity groups are exactly as – they feel exactly as marginalized as they did 20 or 30 years ago. And so that's a real shame.
Yeah.
That's why we think – let's not play the blame game. Let's not play the moralistic game. Let's play the psychology game, which is we have a problem here. We have multiple interacting problems around speech and inclusion. Let's try to solve them all together. And to go back to that wonderful clip you played of Van Jones is basically saying, you know, to students, because he's addressing the black progressive students primarily at Chicago in the context of that speech. He's, and the question was, when Corey Lewandowski, you know, from the Trump administration, when he comes to speak on Chicago's campus, and we don't want to, you know, normalize this, and isn't this offensive? And he's basically telling them, stop it. Stop acting like this is going to traumatize you. I don't want you to be ideologically safe. I want you to be strong.
Yeah. You know, well, in fact, when we come back after a quick break, we'll talk about what some particular college campuses are doing to change this culture. And Chicago's a great place to start, right? Because a couple of years ago, the University of Chicago decided to do away with trigger warnings and safe spaces and no longer disinvite any speakers over student objections. We're speaking with Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff. They are co-authors of the new book, The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. And lots of comments coming in on the website. Someone calling themselves Joss Trends says, like on cigarette packs, we should have warnings on books. Reading may be hazardous to your peace of mind. It might cause independent thinking, and it's addictive. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
As soon as you wake up, you need the latest. That's why Up First is here. It's NPR's morning news podcast. In just 10 minutes or so, you can start your day informed. Listen to Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're joined today by Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt. They're co-authors of the new book, The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. And the comments are pouring in. Someone calling themselves Renato Foucault says, why blame and criticize institutions for their efforts to have some safety from intellectual, emotional, or physical aggression? Those aggressions have aggressors behind them, attack those. Over on Facebook also, Susan Niles says, trigger warnings are absurd. Adults who are at college should be learning a number of skills, including dealing with views that they don't agree with and that might make them uncomfortable. It's about growing up. Whereas Mary Ruth Sanders Bracey says, I teach history and there is a lot of ugly stuff in the past. Trigger warnings don't say, hey, this is hard, you don't have to engage with it. They say, this is an ugly topic. It may make you uncomfortable or angry. It makes other people feel that way, too. So let's talk about it. Let's go to callers. William is calling from Tampa, Florida. You're on the air, William.
Hi, I appreciate you guys taking my call. The reason why I was calling is I'm a former educator in the high school system. And I think, you know, we're talking about college, but in a way, it's systematic or systemic, even in high school, trying to teach rough subjects. I think it comes into two problems. You have, you'll talk, I think the kids want to have that conversation, but there's a way to do it. And I don't think the teachers are either properly trained or they're afraid because they'll have that conversation. The student will go home and say, hey, I had this conversation, and the parents will lose their mind and either make it a problem for the school, the teacher, or they'll go on social media. Mm. And it creates a problem. So I think even back then you have parents, I guess, and in good faith. I mean, they love their children, but they're protecting them in a way where they think, oh, if somebody says this, it's wrong.
Right.
Really? And so at that point, I'll go ahead. And just real quick on a second point, because I was listening to this conversation, is the gentleman that called earlier about, you know, the marginalization of folks. And I was on an online conversation, and I had an individual who was being blatantly, like he was attacking. Mm-hmm. And everybody instantly attacked him back. And I said, hey, tell me about your point. And him and I had gotten this conversation that took like an hour. And he goes, you know, you're the first person that listened to me. And I still didn't agree with him, but it was so quick for people to just destroy him for a different right. viewpoint. And then we ended up having an actual dialogue. So I think we're missing that as well.
William, thank you so much for your call. Jonathan Haidt, excuse me, Jonathan, I keep screwing up your name. It's my apologies. To William's first point there about the concern around reaction from parents, and I was wondering what you thought about that.
Yes. So I think that it gets right at one of the problems. Our first causal thread is the rising polarization of the country at large. Education has always been ground zero in the culture war, even going back to the 60s, and certainly the one we had in the 80s and 90s. And when educators are afraid of getting attacked, you know, if you say anything about politics or, you know, or history, some of the parents on the right might get upset. Other times the parents on the left would get upset. And that means that you're teaching defensively and you can't be as good a teacher. And I think what this points to is that the purpose of a university, I mean, there are many purposes, but a key thing about a university is that it needs to be a place set apart from the normal, from the regular norms of the public square, because what we're trying to do is something very, very hard. It requires trust. It requires the ability to be provocative as long as you don't have ill intent. And I think part of why we're all going crazy these days is that social media is mm-hmm. knocking down the walls between every salon, as it were, every guild, every, you know, each profession needs professional norms to do its work. And, you know, a medical office works differently from a law office, which works differently from a classroom. But social media kind of knocks down the walls that we're all operating under the norms of the public square, where people can yell and scream and call each other out and get likes for posting the most outrageous video. And that means we're all teaching defensively. Students are learning defensively. I think this is why many institutions seem to be coming apart or malfunctioning at the same time.
So, Greg, let me turn back to you on that, because this is a point that's come up a couple of times. I just want to explore it a little bit more deeply, because as John is saying, there is no longer any protective bubble around college campuses, not just social media, but the media at large, the politics of where America is now. And I just want to say, like, there's a lot to that, that perhaps some of the reaction we're seeing is because outside of American college campuses, we have young people who are surrounded by, I'm just going to point to Fox News, for example, where Tucker Carlson spends a lot of time essentially talking about, in not very shaded terms, about, you know, an America that he can no longer recognize because of immigration. He's basically trying to create a national safe space for certain, you know, white Americans or those who don't want any more immigration. That's a kind of safe space that they're forming there on Fox News. But it's in people's faces all the time. So, I mean, the problem seems to be not just on American campuses, but like nobody in the country can deal with opposing viewpoints or things that they fear might cause them harm.
Absolutely. So, 2 points, and I always feel like I have to make this first one all the time. Let's not overestimate how civil things were in the past, mm-hmm. and how nasty and political things could actually be. So, you know, particularly going all the way back to the founding fathers said horrible, horrible things about each other. But when it comes to Tucker Carlson, I'm kind of actually glad you brought him up, because he makes sort of a special appearance in our case, because he had a professor, Lisa Durden, on his show, who defended a party she didn't attend. She's an African-American professor, and she was defending a Black Lives Matter party that only invited black students to it at a college in New Jersey. And after she went on Tucker Carlson to defend the right to have this party, she was fired from her job. And what I find kind of remarkable about the fact that we do see everything through a culture war lens is that when I talk about these cases that don't perfectly fit sort of like a conservative or a liberal kind of stereotype of what cases on campus should look like, they don't get as much attention. But a professor actually being fired for what they said is pretty remarkable. And to this day, she hasn't gotten vindicated.
Mm. John, so let me turn back to you, though, because what you both are really writing about in this book are what are the consequences, right, mm-hmm. for young people, for all the causal reasons we've been talking about, whether these young people are on the right, the middle, or the left, it doesn't really matter. But what are the consequences if we have a generation of young people growing up who are unwilling and unable to engage with and deal with and process points of view and information and opinions that don't comport to their own. I mean, what do you think are the consequences?
Well, I'm really worried. I'm actually kind of pessimistic. I've been focused on political polarization since the early 2000s, and I've gotten very worried about that. That's why I wrote The Righteous Mind. And boy, have things gotten worse since then. So we've got this major national problem. And then if we look to the future, what's it going to be like when the current generation, the young generation, becomes our political leaders? If they have not had the practice of dispute resolution without appeal to authority, then we can predict that however bad our politics is now, when the current generation – and here we're not talking about millennials. We have to make this very clear. The millennials are not really very different at all from Gen X or previous generations. It's birth year 1995 and after. It's what's called iGen or Gen Z. And of course, they're still very young. We don't know what they're going to be like in their 30s and 40s. But we do know they have much, much higher rates of mental illness, only mood disorders. It's not schizophrenia. It's not bipolar. It's only depression and anxiety. And so here's another worrisome prediction. There's been enormous progress on women in all kinds of industries, women's representation, women's visibility, women's successes. And we're making rapid progress on that, especially in the wake of Me Too and concerns about gender equity. When the current generation, when iGen or Gen Z, when they are moving into the job market, If the women there have so much higher rates of depression and anxiety, we might see a fallback. That is, we might find that a large number of their smartest and best educated women are not as strong. So I'm not sure I would bet on this happening. I just want to raise it as a possibility. If we simply extend out.
Since you're talking about higher rates of certain mental illnesses, I mean, just there's always the question of whether or not that's because we're also getting better at identifying it earlier and getting people care they need earlier. That is it that the endemic rate is higher, or again, more people are getting the help they need?
No, that's right. So as a psychologist on the team here, that was my job to figure that out. And so I looked at all the data I could find. And of course, what you say is always a contributor to rising rates, is that just we recognize it more. But what really convinced me was two data sets. One, a separate study looking at hospital admissions, who is going to the hospital because they cut their body, they're self-harming in a way that required a hospital admission. That began to shoot up around 2010, 2011. That begins to shoot up. And it's overwhelmingly the girls, and the biggest increase is the youngest girls. And that's that sort of thing is happening in the UK as well. So social media seems to be having a real effect. Mm. And the most devastating of all, the one that you cannot say has to do with any changing standards, is suicide. The suicide rate was fairly stable in the first decade of the 21st century. And I just took the average the other day. I just looked at it. If you take the average of the first 10 years of the decade, what you find is that – and you compare that to the suicide rate in the last 2 years, what you find is that for boys, the rate is up 25%, which is gigantic. 25% more teenage boys are killing themselves now in America than was the case in the first decade. But the rate for girls is up 70%. 70% more girls are killing themselves. This is not a change in diagnostic criteria. This is despair. This is weak – no, I don't want to say weakness. This is life situations that drove them to kill themselves.
That is sobering, to say the very least.
That was a discovery that definitely when we found it, we were the most horrified by it. And it's one of the things that really encouraged us to go deeper in our research, because how quickly we've been hit by this too is the thing that makes it so remarkable. It's a discontinuity in mental health that even just looking at charts, particularly as it affects women and girls, it's very dramatic.
Okay. I was going to go to a call here, but we've just got 5 minutes left to go. And since both of you have sort of laid out the potential consequences in such dire terms, let's do some problem solving. Here, right?
Sure.
Because
right.
A whole third of your book is about, you have a prescription for how to turn the corner on this. So we just got 5 minutes. We can't touch them all, but let's start with you. What's your top line for parents, for example?
Oh, great. No, but that's top line for parents. Go to letgrow.org. This is a fantastic organization started by Lenore Scanese, who's a friend of both of ours. She wrote Free Range Kids. She has been talking about this at the top of her lungs, although when she screams, it's always a joke because she's very funny. But Lenore has all kinds of ideas for how to let kids have more unsupervised time. Really, really simple ideas. Like, one, get your state legislator to pass a law that you can't be arrested if you let your kids play outside. It's actually called childhood.
As
number
in
two,
Utah. right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Utah did it. So every state should do that now. Number two, when you find spaces that are physically safe to play. Of course, we all care about physical safety. If you find places that are physically safe to play, like the playground at the school, open it an hour early. Keep it open 2 hours late. Why should kids always have to have piano lessons and soccer practices when they most need is just time to play? So there's all kinds of great ideas for giving kids the kind of independence that kids always had until the 1990s.
Two very good ones there. I'm always a big champion of modeling as well. So maybe as parents, we ought to model how to have civil discourse and how to engage with ideas that that don't necessarily align with our own. Greg, what about college campuses? I mean, we did mention very briefly that the University of Chicago has made some significant changes. What should change on campuses?
Oh, absolutely. So on the one hand, universities, you know, have to take the mental health crisis in a way more seriously. Trigger warnings are sort of a symbolic but band-aid solution. But if you really have increase in suicides, you have to actually provide more resources. On the other hand, there's a lot of sort of throwing up our hands, like there's nothing we can do about the situation for discourse on campus. Meanwhile, very few colleges that I know of even explain the importance of civil disagreement, of academic freedom, of freedom of speech, or model that by having debates and discussions. So what Chicago did was they issued a wonderful statement on freedom of speech and academic freedom that updates academic freedom norms for the age of microaggressions and trigger warnings and disinvitations. And I think every school in the country should adopt it because it's a great way to tell students in advance that the atmosphere you're about to enter has different rules and it's about the about trying to get to truth. And that's going to be, if done correctly, difficult.
Well, you know what? I just want to sneak in one last call here because this person is a recent college grad. Sophie, we've just got a couple of seconds here, but I want to get you in here. You're calling from Providence, Rhode Island. What's your thought?
Yes. Thank you so much. I just wanted to speak to what your guests are talking about the culture of debate on college campuses. And something that I learned when I was in school was that I really think that your caller's presupposition that academic debate is this sort of total panacea answer to every single issue facing America today, you know, the youth of today that they're wringing their hands about, and that by the nature of academic debate just existing, there is a level playing field that everybody who comes to college walks into. I think that that is really sort of missing the point that college today looks totally different than it did a decade ago. We actually are seeing much more plural student bodies in most universities around the nation. You have first-generation college students. You have students of color. You have a ton of women students.
Sophie, you're going to have to forgive me. You're going to have to forgive me for interrupting you because we've just got like a minute left to go. But and I think I know where you're heading with your point, that there is real racism and sexism and other isms that a more diverse student body has to face now than perhaps they did a generation ago. John Haidt, let me turn back to you on that because I think she's making a good point, but also she's talking about how, you know, there's a broader society that we have to think about that's entering college campuses here. So what do we do there?
Yeah. Well, so if we're really talking about hostility, racism, exclusion, those are important things. Those are the sorts of things that we try to work on, where we have committees that are always looking for ways to reform. But I'd like to question the idea of a level playing field. A level playing field is important in a soccer match in the finals. But if you were to spread that idea that I will not participate in any discussion until I'm on a level playing field, I mean, no immigrant group has ever faced a level playing field. They come places, they work hard, they bring certain virtues that are often lacking in the locals, as we see in America, where immigrants are actually more successful than native-born Americans. There are many choices we can make about how to interpret a situation. And to not engage unless it's a perfectly level playing field, I think that ultimately harms members of those groups.
Well, Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff are co-authors of the new book, The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. John and Greg, thank you so very much. This is it's a really fascinating book and worth reading. And I especially appreciated the last section where you talk about, you know, like, what can we do? Essentially, your message is that individuals, parents, universities, and society, we all got to get wiser, right?
Bingo.
Well, thanks so much for joining us again today. And listeners, keep your comments coming. We know a lot of folks care about this. OnPointRadio.org is the place to go. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.